We read from Luke's Gospel, chapter 2. Now his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover. And when he was 12 years old, they went up according to custom. And when the feast was ended, as they were returning, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. His parents did not know it. But supposing him to be in the company, they went a day's journey, and they sought him among their kinfolk and acquaintances. And when they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem seeking him. After 3 days, they found him in the temple, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. And when they saw him, they were astonished. And his mother said to him, "Son, why have you treated us so? Behold, your father and I have been looking for you anxiously." And he said to them, "How is it that you sought me? Did you not know that I must be about my father's business?" Darn kids nowadays. Sunday school book pictures notwithstanding, you know, those that have the haloed Jesus sitting surrounded by old guys in rapt attention and seemingly high praise. That's not how it was. If this story, and of course we know how the story ended, Jesus, the boy in the temple, winds up the man who cleansed the temple and wound up on the cross. And if that whole story was a murder mystery, and we were surprised at how it ended, we would then look back and say, oh, we should have seen a clue way back when he was 12 in the temple. This is Luke, the evangelist, writing the story. The story of Jesus in the temple appears only in Luke's gospel. It's later in the chronicling of Jesus' life. And there are several other things that appear only in Luke to which this gives rise. Remember also that this is a very tense and contentious environment in the world in the first century. Jerusalem is the capital of a Roman colony. And the Romans care not a whit of the religiousness or the relative level of faith or concern about God. All they care about is whether the Jews pay tribute and keep order. Well, they pay tribute in part because of corrupt taxation processes. They keep order through religious extremism. Adultery is a capital crime in first century Jerusalem, and there's a long list of capital crimes, including blasphemy, which Jesus has just committed. The Taliban have nothing on the first century Jews who are colonists of Rome. And the Romans are much worse in terms of their keeping order by force, terror, and corruption. The only reason Jesus lives to his 13th year is that he's too young to be executed for blasphemy. But don't think for a minute that all who were amazed at his wisdom lost sight of that. And there's interesting imagery. They find him after 3 days. Well, where else have we heard after 3 days he did this or that? He's in the same temple that on the last week of his life he comes in and destroys and disrupts the corruption from which tribute is gathered, which keeps peace in Jerusalem, which keeps the Romans from killing them. He disrupts that whole thing. This is the same temple about which he said, "I will destroy it and rebuild it in 3 days." That sealed the deal. What is he doing? At age 12, he is already showing us that he is, in his own words, about his father's business. Well, what is his father's business? I want to talk about that for a little while. His father's business continues to be our business, so let's pay attention to that and see, in the context of Luke's version of the larger story, what's he about? What does he do? And how does it affect us? I think his father's business, first of all, and Jesus is about this, he's putting power in perspective. He is at the seat of both a political power, headquartered in Rome, and a religious power, again, the extremist control and corrupt first century Judaism. And he's saying, guess what? You got nothing on where I'm coming from. You can't imagine where I'm going. And you ain't seen nothing yet. For Jesus, power is not temporal. For Jesus, the power he has been given is the power to overcome all other power. You know, we think about difficulties and things that frighten us with regard to, let's say, nuclear power. How is it going to be used? How is it safeguarded? What happens if it's weaponized? And so on. Nuclear power is simply a natural resource that comes from the Creator God. We take the means to both heat our homes and destroy all life from the ground the Creator has given us, and the Creator has given us choices. Nuclear power, you ain't seen nothing yet. Fifth grade astronomy class teaches us that this massive light that comes up in the east every morning, although it's the Earth that moves, etc., etc., it's 93 million miles and change away from us. If it is fractionally further away, and I mean minuscule in that fractionally further away, we freeze. If it's fractionally closer to us, we burn up. Very precisely placed, this, well, as it turns out by comparison, fairly lukewarm star, but the most powerful thing we can imagine, just one other piece in the sky that God created. You ain't seen nothing yet. Jesus puts power in perspective. The temple? I will destroy it and rebuild it in 3 days. A threat, a crime, and a metaphor. You ain't seen nothing yet. That's his Father's business. Destroy the power of death and bring life from it. Power in perspective. Secondly, he takes provincialism, or at least Luke does as he writes the story, and throws it out the window. Luke's gospel is unique in that it extends the mission and ministry of Jesus and those in the early church beyond Jerusalem to places where the outcasts are, where the political and cultural enemies live. Luke is the only gospel of the four that has the Good Samaritan in it, highlighting the people of that outcast country. It's the only gospel that has the character of Zacchaeus in it, the corrupt tax collector with whom Jesus has dinner. And if that doesn't get the point across, Luke's second book, which is the book of Acts, it's sort of Luke's gospel chapter 2, has a variety of characters and images that are unique to his telling of the story. The First Theological Seminary has a woman on the faculty. Priscilla and her husband Aquila go school up this guy Apollos, who's got it about half right. One of the interesting characters in Luke's second act, the book of Acts, is a Roman governor named Cornelius, who gets wind of St. Peter's preaching and the congregation surrounding him, and surprisingly says, I'm intrigued. I want in. Can I bring my family? The Roman centurion, the killers above the corrupt. And Peter says, you're in the club. Come on in. I don't know his name. He's referred to as the Ethiopian eunuch from Ethiopia, obviously African, masculinity open to question. Runs into the Apostle Philip on the road, Luke tells us, and asks a provocative question. What's to prevent me from being baptized? Me, in all of what I am. Philip says, apparently nothing. He's baptized on the spot. His Father's business is about taking this message of power and grace and inclusiveness beyond where we would expect it, maybe even beyond where we would want it. His Father's business, to put power into perspective, to send the message to all. And thirdly, and Jesus does this himself in the course of his ministry, and it's almost as an aside, his Father's business is to ask us to recapture the mindset of the child. Jesus seems especially fond of children. Well, who isn't? But not because they're always sweet. They mostly aren't. They can be annoying and troublesome and invasive and the absolute delight of your life. The mindset of the child. Frederick Buechner is a fellow Presbyterian minister who captures the essence of this far better than I can. It's one of my favorite little mini essays. He says, when the disciples, over earnest as ever, asked Jesus who was the greatest in the kingdom of heaven, Jesus pulled a child out of the crowd and said the greatest in the kingdom of heaven were people like this, a mindset. 2,000 years of sentimentalizing to the contrary notwithstanding, Jesus was not playing Captain Kangaroo. He was saying that the people who get into heaven are people who, like children, don't worry about it very much. They are people who, like children, live with their hands open more than with their fists clenched. They are people who, like children, and this is my favorite turn of phrase in this entire book of essays, they are people who, like children, are so relatively unburdened by preconception that if somebody says there's a pot of gold at the end of that rainbow, they're perfectly willing to go take a look for themselves. You know, we don't get a lot of rainbows in West Texas. But I'd go look. The mindset of the child, he asks us to recapture the mindset of the child as he essentially says, you can't understand this through your own intellect or through your own education. You can only understand this in the same way a child understands that good things will happen when they hang up a Christmas stocking or they put a tooth under a pillow. Now, all of us know better, but we also know what it feels like to be expectant and to hope for good things. And Jesus says, I can't explain eternity to you, but I can show you what it feels like to expect it, like this. And he pulls a kid out of the mix. The next time you are overburdened with worry, the next time you are crushed, seemingly, by circumstance, or grief, or illness, or any threat to you or someone you love, take a breath and close your eyes and remember what it felt like to put out cookies and hang up a stocking, the hope that goes with that, to put a tooth under a pillow, maybe just to look into the eyes of a child in your life who just did that. We got good news last night. We have a new child in our life who hasn't done that yet. And we'll get a chance to watch the first time, you know. His name is Joshua Clark Butler. And he is the last of his generation, presumably. He is named for his great-great-great-great-grandfather, Joshua Clark. Clark as in a descendant of the same Clark with Lewis who discovered the Pacific Ocean, or at least mapped a route to it. Joshua Clark, infant Joshua's great-great-great-great-grandfather, among his many other accomplishments in life, built a cradle that the family still has, a cradle that is ready to receive him in Austin, Texas, in a couple of days. He will be the sixth generation to get rest in what was made by his namesake. There is symmetry to that. There is connection to that. There is hope in that. And those are just details. You know, Lewis and Clark, Joshua Clark, the cradle, this child. Everybody's got a story that connects who we are to who went before us. And we were also named for the one who started a story he knew would end as it did by committing a capital crime as a 12-year-old in the temple and simply setting in motion what was necessary to give us the wit and the will and the mindset and the energy to live with hope and to live and leave here at peace. Amen.